Hello, welcome to episode 191 of the Edge of Futurist podcast. I think it is today. It may well not be. We make numbers up sometimes, but 191, I think it is. Gents, it is good to be back. Steve, good to have you back after a little jolly last week. Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I've not been at home for a week and a bit now, so it's nice to be back in Yorkshire. So it was Wales, Spain, and then Dublin. So I was up at 4 a.m. this morning to fly back. So yeah, it's good to be back. Good to be joining, and good that I missed last week. But yeah, it's been a good week. It's been an interesting one.
We know you'll listen to it, and you'll have gleaned everything that me and Dan.
I will 100% listen to it because I wasn't on it. Like, the only reason I can hear my own voice in my head as well as the other voices. And apologies, I put the listeners through that most weeks. But yeah, it's been a good week. Good to be back. And exciting times. Looking forward to this one.
Dan, how are you, sir? Good week?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. Yeah, all good. Good week. All round good week.
It's that time of year where it's like it's not the summer anymore. It's too early to talk about the C word, and holidays. Holidays are not there's not there seem to be a far away, and it's starting to get dark at night and it's raining. So, welcome to the UK. And if you're not in the UK, that's what you'd look forward to in October and November. So, I'm probably not selling houses.
Let's just clarify that. The C word, you mean Christmas?
Yeah. I do mean that C word, the C word.
Relieved there.
You can say both. Maybe not on the podcast for the other one, but you can say Christmas. Of course we can. I asked my wife the other day, I said, is it too early for Home Alone yet?
Never too early for Home Alone. No. Home Alone could potentially be a year-round movie. We like Home Alone in our house as well. So, it's good to be back. Good to have another episode of the podcast. And it's great to be welcoming our guest today. We're going to bring in a moment. And just to remind guests that listeners, that when we bring guests in, we obviously are always thinking about how do we talk about this idea around the future of education. If you didn't listen to episode 190, then please jump onto your podcast episode suppliers, whatever, what's it called? Studio, whatever it is, podcast.
I'm loving seeing you squirm, so I'm not going to help out. I'm not going to help him.
Spotify, what are they called? Podcast providers. That's the word I was looking for. Podcast providers. Wow, you'd think that I've never done this before. Podcast providers. And I listened to episode 190. Me and Dan chewed the fat last week about like the idea about strategy and innovation and the idea around box 3 and thinking about this idea around how do we look at education and what could be by whilst also working on the present and letting go of some of the things of the past as well. So that's what we want to do. That's what we want to get into. And we're really excited to have Sean Jones on the call today. And he's going to be joining us to talk about all sorts of stuff, but we are going to get into the idea around creativity in education. So let's bring Sean into the studio. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Just for our listeners who may not know who you are, can you give us a brief synopsis of you and what you do?
Yeah, so basically, Sean Jones. I'm the founder of a consultancy called Prototype, which is really focused around using creative methodologies to help organisations with change. So how can I inject some creative ways of working to enable them to really open up and express new ways of thinking, new ideas, and really to help them sort of look at the future in a different way, something which I think, is severely lacking, not only in industry, but I think within education as well, which I know we're going to get into. My background is a creative one, so I've spent much of my career in brand agency world, working with lots and lots of different types of brands, big and small, from large retailers to small startups. Around strategy, innovation, and creativity. And more recently, I actually created my own brand as well, which we had some ups and downs through the course of COVID, like so many. And again, that was a creative product, but I suspect we'll probably get into a little bit of that. But yeah, fundamentally, I suppose my raison d'etre is really, how can I facilitate change through creativity? That's what I'm really passionate about.
Love it. And So you've come from a brand world originally, and I've gone through loads of iterations. And I know that we don't want to spend loads of time on the conversation about the den and being in the den, but I know that's part of the story as well. Yeah. So for those of you who can we go there? Can we start with that? Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's talk about the den. So in around sort of middle of 2017, I co-founded a business called Punkbox. With a fellow creative who he and I had obviously spent some years working together in the creative world. And we'd recently come out of the creative agency world, and I was doing some consulting, and we were looking at ways in which we could potentially work together. And we came up with this concept, this idea of really helping kids to get creative with reuse. So there was a sustainability angle to the concept in terms of how could we help children to be playful around the concept of recycling and reusability. So we came up with this idea of creating creative products that you could effectively team up with packaging suppliers, the likes of Amazon, obviously, HelloFresh, Gusto, where we would effectively add on our product to their packaging. So imagine the first people we actually spoke to was HelloFresh. We presented the concept back to them, as I said, back in about 2017. They loved it. The idea was we would take their box, it would come into the home, parents would unpack the box, get the recipe and the ingredients and the food out. You're left with a box. Kids love playing with boxes. It's something we all know. You know, at Christmas time, kid gets the present, opens the box, throws the present away, plays with the box and the wrapping paper. So we were really just playing on that idea. But we were enabling those children's imaginations to run wild, but we were giving them a little bit of help. So you could turn that box into a pirate ship, into a racing car, into a fairy tale castle, whatever. You know, we'd obviously come up with lots of different ideas around that. And so we were founded by Dragon's Den in around 2019. We'd been conceptualizing. We'd got to the point where we were just about to launch a product, and they found us. And I think because we were both working on a creative level with children, but also a sustainable angle, they were very interested in us, you know, ask us if basically we'd come on to Dragons. We did, we interviewed, we got on, and then we had the harrowing few months of run-up to getting onto the Dragons and then getting onto the Dragons itself. And I have to say, doing Dragons Den itself was not that awful. It was all of the work that was required in the run-up to it. I think most people probably imagine there isn't a huge amount of work to be done. And certainly from some of the episodes I'd seen and some of the car crashes, you'd certainly think that those people on the show didn't know each other, never mind did any work in preparation for it. We did quite a lot of work in terms of preparation. And I think because we were so early on in the business, we literally were putting together our business plan, forecasting, all of these things that you have to do for the BBC to show that you're effectively going to be a viable business, so that when you go on and present yourself to the Dragons, that you're not going to kind of completely fall over. It was really good. We thought we were probably going to be a bit early because we weren't at that point actually selling product, and clearly the Dragons want you to be already selling. So we didn't end up getting funding in the show itself, but it was incredibly good PR. We actually had a really good show. We weren't trashed completely, excuse the pun, but we weren't trashed completely by the Dragons, and it was actually a really good experience.
Yeah, it's always embarrassing when someone gets asked a basic finance question about their balance sheet and they fall apart. Horrendous. I remember watching that episode, Sean. I watched it, and it's really interesting because I like watching Dragon's Den, and so I've obviously seen tens and tens, if not hundreds, of different pictures on that show over the years. But actually, that one really stuck with me. Every time I go into a shop and see something similar, it always pops back into my mind, because you can buy cardboard board packages with that kids can turn into toys. Doesn't obviously have that sustainability element to it, because they're actually making the cardboard for it initially to be a toy, and it's not being reused. But every time I do see it, your pitch always jumps back into my head, and I remember it. It was a good one.
And I think the one thing that people never realize actually is all these little secrets behind the scenes. You know, things people ask you about the lift. Well, actually, it isn't a lift. It's just a set of sliding doors. You know, you don't go up and down. And also, we were in there for about an hour and a half being grilled. And you just in one take. You know, there's no stops or anything like
that. And the studio, not the lift, for an hour and a half.
I would have been in the hot and sweaty if I'd have been in the lift for an hour and a half, I assure you. But yeah, you go in, you hit your mark, and you're away. And they do it in one take. But that, you know, because both of us were from agency background, we were used to pitching, that piece of it wasn't so bad, it wasn't so difficult. I think it was actually the entire run-up. But we got there, we started shooting at 6:30 in the morning, or we were preparing at 6:30 in the morning. We didn't actually get on until 4:30 in the afternoon. So we had hours of pacing around in the green room, which was basically a few custard creams and a couple of, you know, packets of crisps stuck in a corner of a shabby little room. And so you had that kind of initial kind of motivation in the morning of, right, going over your pitch, being ready, to the point of, okay, we just want to get on now, you know. Yeah. And then you get a half an hour warning, and then you've got to kind of G yourself up again after being in there for about 8 or 9 hours. But it was a great experience. I'm glad we did it. And even though we didn't get the funding, it did give us a boost. There was no doubt about it. We got quite a lot of website coverage post that. But, you know, we'd never really intended for the brand to be a direct consumer. It was more, the idea was really about piggybacking other bigger brands and really working on their networks, if you will, and having sort of, you know, so discussions with the likes of Amazon. The whole point was, if we could get our packs, our creative kits into every Amazon box, you know, that would be millions of boxes around the world that could be reused for fun. And just getting that idea of creativity back into kids' heads, you know. It's the classic thing of like Lego, and obviously I do some stuff with Lego, but, you know, there's so many amazing Lego kits now, but how much do they actually enable the kids to truly use their imaginations? I'm going back some years, you know, I'm kind of in my early 50s now, but when I was a kid, you know, a bag of Lego, you kind of took it and you just made all sorts of different things, you know. You didn't have any guidance around it. And so that ability for you just to imagine what you could create was kind of limitless, really. And I think that's what we were trying to inject a little bit back into that idea.
I think that was an almost seamless segue. Almost seamless. It's like you've done pitches and stuff like this before to segue into a conversation around Lego. So I think just what's always really interesting, and I always like to tell this kind of story, is that I've never met a kid who doesn't love Lego at some level. Some kids are obsessed with it. Some kids just do bits. I've got two girls who both love Lego and love all different variations of it and making their own stuff or following models or putting the robotics into it and all that kind of stuff. They love all that kind of stuff. But then when I was in education, I was quite fortunate to do some of the stuff around Spike and some of the earlier stuff around robotics in education, and just saw children come alive with it. And I know that you don't just use it for in education, but it works in loads of different ways. So I think as we get into it, I think the idea around the principles we'll get into, but tell us a little bit about your what Lego means, and maybe even start where, why, how and why you got into it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got my little Lego duck. Obviously, our listeners won't be able to see this, but I've got a little duck with me. It's interesting, actually, because when I came out of agency world, I'd been very involved in innovation and design, and I found that as a general rule within the industry, that it took an awful long time for creative projects to come to life. Lots of steps, lots of time, lots of money. And I was really interested, especially with my background, because before I got into the creative world, I was very much in the technical world around packaging development. So I understood and I understand a lot about how you get products into market and packaging and how that works and supply chain. And so I was always interested in the idea of prototyping. And so with doing insights and innovation sort of latterly in my creative career, if you will, within the industry, the design industry, when I came out, I thought there was there a better way of being able to prototype, rapid prototype, come up with ideas quickly. And I was thinking this very much in the brand world at that point. But I went to a Google Labs conference, and it was all about connecting the brain and your hands. It was this idea of, you know, we do so much thinking in our heads, we intellectualize everything, that we forget about our other senses. We forget about our gut, our hands that we use for creativity. And one of the sessions had a lady who presented Lego Serious Play. I'd never heard of it before. And on the tables were just, you know, a few bits of Lego. And during her session, which was maybe 30 minutes long, she encouraged us to play with the Lego. And she asked us a few questions and asked us to build something in response to those questions. And for me, it came at a time which was quite crucial because I was trying to think of what I was going to do next. I'd come out of agency. Where am I going to go next? And it was kind of like this little lightning bolt hit me. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Because I just had this character that I kind of picked up and I did some things with it. And it was me. It was a representation of me. And I was able to articulate through this little model, if you will, it was a metaphor, to sort of start thinking about what it is that I could do. And I immediately got the Lego bug, and I had to go away and learn to become a facilitator. So I did. I booked myself onto a course. I became an accredited facilitator. I got to spend a week at Windsor, Legoland Windsor, which in a bedroom that was completely Lego. It was quite bizarre. But it was really insightful. I actually did some training with an ex-Danish army officer who had used it in the Danish army. They'd used Lego as a tool for war games and how they could problem solve by using it. So it was really interesting. So I learned about the use of this thing called Lego Serious Play and the serious element to it. But at its heart was this ability to enable people to play and to express ideas and really free themselves up. And that's what I find with it. I find it's an incredibly powerful tool and that I now use quite a lot, actually. It really plays a centerpiece in my consulting. It's really a way of opening people up. You get them relaxed and you can get them into a creative flow and you can get them to express things and ideas they would normally find very, very difficult to do. And it kind of comes back to this heart of creativity as well, which I find really interesting, both in and out of education, is that still lots of people think creativity is the arts, the ability to draw something or make something or be artistically talented. And I think that's one part of it. I think creativity has so many different facets that everybody's creative. As Picasso said, I think, that every child is born an artist. And I think that's true. I think every child is born an artist. But somewhere along the line, and probably to quote the great Sir Ken Robinson, you know, creativity often gets educated out of us. You know, rightly or wrongly or on purpose, it kind of happens. And we lose that sense of creativity as we get older. And therefore, when we're older, if we can't paint, draw, you know, write poetry, we don't think we're creative. Well, actually, we are. We problem solve. And to problem solve, to meet the challenges, any challenge, whether it's work or in life, you often have to be creative. So I think we kind of underestimate our ability to be creative. And what I like about the Lego is it pulls people back into that childhood state. So when I get people coming into the room, inevitably, I would say that I get 90% of people coming in and I get oohs and ahs and I love to hear that because they go, oh, Lego, fantastic. These are adults ranging from anything from their, you know, early 20s to their late 50s, you know. And I get some cynics. People are, oh, you know, what are you going to do to me now? You know, you're putting Lego in front of me. But I can guarantee you by the end of a session, even the most cynical people walk away having gained something valuable, either knowing something about themselves that they perhaps hadn't thought about or expressed, or thinking in a different way. So I just really love the way it liberates, if you like, creativity and enables a conversation and a dialogue between people that I think they would find much more difficult to have in such a short space of time. Within an hour, I can have people talking about things and expressing ideas and challenging and problem solving, you know, in such a quick way and in such a fun way as well. I think that's really, really important. And that's why I love Lego Serious Play so much. I think it's a very powerful tool.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I don't know if you know much about IDEO, the design thinking consultancy in America. Yeah. I think they're probably the biggest in the world. And they very much, when they're going through the design thinking process, they have paper, sellotape, crafts, everything on the table, and they're like their team members to, as soon as possible, to start sticking things together and creating prototypes, because it helps with that innovation process.
Absolutely. Iteration is really important. I if I'm writing a presentation or a piece of strategy or a deck for something or whatever that thing is, I will always sketch out, I'll always draw out. It doesn't matter if you're good or not, right? That's not the point. The point is I'm using my hands. About 80% of your brain cells apparently connected to your fingertips. So there's a deep connection between our physicality and our brains. And I always say to people when they're building, if when I ask them a question, they're struggling to come up with an answer. And let's be honest, any of us, when we're asked a question, can sometimes go blank. Or if it's quite a complex question and we need to work it out, I always say to them, don't worry. If the idea is not coming, just start putting the bricks together. Start sticking things together. The ideas will come. There is a magic. It's not a very technical term, but there is definitely a magic that happens when you start to use your hands. And it's like anything. If you're doodling, if you're thinking over something. And so whenever I'm preparing for something, I find it really helpful just to sketch out, to use paper, post-it notes, stick things on a wall, visualize my thinking. I like to think this is almost, it is, it's kind of prototyping your ideas. It's visualizing your thinking, which makes it much easier for people then to take that next step. If you try and work everything out in your head, it stays there. You've got to get it out of your head, onto paper, onto a screen, into a Lego model, whatever that thing is, and it will open up avenues and channels and thoughts that you wouldn't otherwise have got to so easily.
Yeah, I like that. I like that idea of play as well. So obviously that idea about we become a little bit too serious, don't we? I like the term serious play. That stuff, I think it's Montessori stuff, isn't it? About the player being the work of the child and actually it being work. And if you do that effectively, you can enjoy the playing. And you watch, even in sport, you watch people who their job is to do that stuff, and it's playful as they do it. Music is playful. It's interesting, actually. You say you play football and you play music, but we don't play teaching. We don't play banking because they become serious things, and they're like the proper things that you've got to get to. I love that idea of encouraging play. I imagine there's going to be some barriers to that, in not just in the cynics that come into the room, but there'll be your businesses that you work with or others that you work with that are like, nah, I'm not sure about this play malarkey and what it actually leads to. So how do you kind of deal with that kind of?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. I like to think of it, and coming back to that point about play, it's play with purpose. And I've learned, you know, using it over the years, you're absolutely right. There can be some barriers. Some people can be cynical. It's play, it's Lego, it's a toy, it's a child's thing. I always try and ask them to imagine that, you know, rather than thinking about it as being Lego, it's a tool. It's a tool that enables you to do things that you would otherwise be challenged to do with your teams. And I do a lot of work with teams. I actually do quite a lot of work, interestingly, with corporates and with the types of businesses that you wouldn't normally think of as being particularly brave or creative. And I find that quite interesting and quite liberating, actually. Some of the most, what we think has been the most conservative industries are the ones that are actually embracing this, which I find incredibly liberating. I think the fact that we are now more than ever in need of innovative and different ways of thinking, of how we can engage and connect with our own teams, our own staff, our audiences. So people are really now much more open to different approaches. And I, at the end of the day, talk about it's my job to help them get to the places they want to get to. And I happen to use creative methodologies. Lego is one of those things, but lots of other tools. And as we talked about, whiteboards and post-it notes and pads and pens and things like that, just as a way of, again, getting people to open up. And I find generally that there isn't a huge amount of resistance. You know, sometimes I won't get through the door because of that. But more often than not, I'm finding that people are much more open to it than you would have thought.
And do you see, especially with the big businesses that you work with, and even, I suppose, the small, the decision makers and the leaders who are bringing those teams together, do they all follow the same type of individual and same type of leadership that brings them to this conversation and your work? Do they have to be open-minded themselves to explore it in this way, yeah, rather than try to be, I'm going to tell them what to do kind of thing, rather than explore
it? Yeah, I think so. Well, absolutely. I think, you know, most of the time, the conversations I have, it's with leaders that, you know, they've got challenges and they're trying to solve those problems with their teams. And they know, they've been there themselves and sat through, as we all have, I'm sure, we've sat in conferences and workshops and where it's it's not particularly creative. It's not particularly inspiring. It's a little bit dry, or somebody gets you doing some really crazy stuff, which is embarrassing. And nobody wants that. You know, people need to feel safe in that space. So yeah, I tend to find that they are a bit more open-minded. They sometimes need a little bit of convincing, which hopefully I do when I have a conversation with them. And obviously I can show them case studies and referrals of where other like-minded organizations, big organizations, have worked. I mean, I've worked with some of the largest law firms in the world using Lego, you know, and you wouldn't think a law firm necessarily would be particularly creative, but they've been very open to it because they recognize the need to change and be more innovative. And so, you know, that word of mouth and those referrals and those organizations seeing like-minded organizations using it, it kind of makes it more, you know, it makes it easier for them to kind of enter into doing it. I think once we have that conversation and they understand that there's a serious and tangible outcome at the end of this, that's the most important thing for them. What they want to see is, well, not the most important, it's one of the most important things. They want tangible outcomes. So I always work with them on that basis. We will come out with tangible outcomes at the end of this. But along the way, we will engage with your teams in an inspiring way. They will collaborate, you know, brilliantly together. They will get to know each other. They will build empathy for each other. So there's lots of themes here, which I think is really interesting. And when I was thinking about even before this conversation, how we link some of the various things that I do, I can see a natural link between lots of those things, you know, around empathy, around creativity, you know, and that very much comes into the work that I'm doing more and more with teams. You know, we are talking about, you know, building a culture of empathy and how we can better enable those teams to collaborate and to problem solve together, and then have, you know, actual behaviors at the end of these sessions where they'll walk away and say, these are our behaviors, this is what we're going to stand for, and this is how we're going to act in the future. And so they get some really tangible outcomes out of something that they have a huge amount of fun doing. And you can't, the play bit, you can't underestimate that. I've had countless people come back at the end of it and just say, well, that was, I really enjoyed, that was a fantastic session, and we got something purposeful out of it.
Ben linked it to Montessori, and there's a book around the Danish toddler and play and choice and all of that, but it always fascinated me, you know, in my role as a chair of governance at a primary, and I know Ben is involved as well, that whole thing of early years really focuses on this area of play, creativity, development, and then that's done and it's like, no, it's serious education now. And I think there is still a feature much more in primary than there is in secondary around play and creativity and choice. But it always fascinated, and I always push back to this, why is there not a more of a play rather than, you've got your early years, as soon as you hit year one, you change your approach. Why is it that we do it that way rather than some of the other approaches across the globe? And it fascinates me how can we create an early years model across all education sectors and in the business sense? And I'm not talking about water and sand, you know, and all that. But I think that's the fascinating bit that, I just don't know why I think it's a rigidity of what we've created ourselves rather than the fact that you get to the age of five or six and you the way that you want to learn changes, I think.
I totally agree. I think I think you're right. I think in the early years and probably through to sort of key stage one and even maybe into key stage two a little bit, you know, you still got a lot of creativity. I mean, I always, whenever I have sessions with adults, I always talk about that we're going back to childhood here. When you look at children, they have no previous experience. They don't have any real knowledge. They have to learn everything. And they generally learn that through play, whether it's Lego or drawing or building or playing games or whatever that thing is, music, etc. So they're their most innovative, or we are our most innovative when we are children, because we're having to imagine all of the time. We're having to make things up. We don't know what's possible or impossible. And I think that we lose that as we get older. And I think that partly is because we spend such a huge amount of our time as young people, then going into adults, in a very structured environment where we're being taught in a particular way. And obviously, I'm not an educational expert, so I can't speak to the various advances that are occurring. So I'm sure now in lots of areas of education, we're starting to see more critical thinking coming into that education process. But I think still largely the curriculum that, you know, schools follow and that senior schools follow is probably not so dissimilar to what we've been following for the last 50 years. And I think it feels like it needs a real revolution, if I'm absolutely honest.
Because
I think
yes, preach that. That's what we say every week on here.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think, you know, if we look at creativity as an industry in this country alone, actually we're very, very successful at being creative in the UK. And we have some of the world's leading creative businesses and agencies and innovative companies. Yet we still, and that adds huge value to our, you know, our economy. But yet we still haven't quite backfilled into education. And if you talk now to a lot of employers and they're talking about young people coming into the world of work, one of the things they're complaining about is this kind of lack of critical thinking, this lack of ability to be able to think outside of a very narrow way of thinking. And yeah, I don't know how we need to get this into schools either, but there certainly needs to be, I think it needs to be seen as valuable. Creativity in education needs to be seen as valuable as literacy, because we start out life being super creative with no literacy. We're then taught literacy and kind of creativity disappears. If we're all so creative and we're all so diverse, I mean, we're all very, very different, then surely creativity can help that diversity shine. And surely as a society, we'll be so much richer for releasing that diversity. And that will create in itself new jobs. I mean, you know, when we look at innovation, we look at entrepreneurs, you know, quite often those entrepreneurs will have not done particularly well at school. It won't have been the right channel of education for them, but they've come up with a great idea and they found a way to express that idea in a different way. So we are seeing innovation, regardless of education. And again, that's not to put education down. I'm sure there are lots of great examples where it's working really, really well. And there are some very progressive institutions around that. But I think on the whole, I'd love to see us having a strand of creativity, not just, you know, designing technology, not just the artistic lessons that happen in school or music and all of those wonderful things, but actually how can we use creativity for critical thinking to enable kids to use that age-old term of thinking outside of the box a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the problems is that a revolution requires creativity, doesn't it? You need to be creative to realize where you need to go and figure out a new path, a new future. And it's something we talked about this a lot in the last episode, just between ourselves, and that idea of for businesses to survive now in the business world, they have to. And we're using a framework called the three box solution to innovation, where you've got to do some box three thinking, which is reading the kind of the faint whispers from the future and what's coming, and then trying to, alongside what you're already doing, trying to build that future in your own business. And a lot of companies they've got to do that to survive. They've got to continually be doing that. And then in box one, you've got, well, this is what we've always done, but we slowly evolve, or we make it more efficient. And it seems like education has just got stuck in that box one. We know what we do. We know how we're supposed to do it. And we just, year on year, over the last few hundred years, just get more efficient at it, a little bit more efficient, to the point where, and we made the argument last week that's a factory, isn't it? That's what a factory does. Some of the most amazing bits of engineering and bespoke engineering take place in factories, where it's getting that, the start of the production line at the end of the production line, to be the most efficient system for that product for those workers. And we seem to have got into that model of just slowly trying to make our systems more efficient without actually questioning if it's the right model to have in the first place, if it's the right thing we should be doing, and without actually going into that box three thinking and going, right, actually what can we build alongside it? And we, there are places doing it, and it's kind of what we do week in, week out. We interview innovative educators around the world who are kind of bucking the trend and looking outside of it. But when it comes to the system of education, especially in the UK, especially in England, probably more specifically, that ability to innovate, to think, right, well, how could it be done? And just doesn't, we seem to be stuck in a world of where we think we already know how it's supposed to be done until the end of time. And let's just get better at doing that.
Yeah, I think you make a really interesting point. I think if we think about when education was created, it was created for the Industrial Revolution, wasn't it? It was created for manufacturing, for businesses, it was kind of, its output was to turn out people that could fit into those molds. And we don't have industry anymore. We have this plethora and breadth of businesses and all sorts of things and dynamics going on in the world. But our education system really still operating for industry. And so it's not surprising that, you know, it's quite a challenge, because it almost feels like in some ways that you could argue that it's going in the wrong direction. It's a bit like a huge tanker. Mm. And it is going to need a revolution to turn it around. It's a bit like saying, if you could recreate education from ground up, would we be doing what we're doing now? I suspect we wouldn't be. Yeah. And the thing is, the future is unknown. You know, it's always unknown. But yet we go through these years of education almost being taught as if it is a known. So you're taught in a specific way to go down a specific route, as if there's a known thing at the end of it. You know, yes, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if you got a good education, went to university, you could walk into a job. You do that now, you go to university, there's no guarantee there's going to be a job at the end of it. And in the world's completely changed. So the whole dynamic has changed. So it's not only schools, it's also universities. You know, everybody's having to look at this. And this is interesting why we're now starting to see more apprenticeships and you know, students going straight from schools into industry again. And perhaps that's a way of doing it, if industry can also, you know, can adapt itself.
Yeah, and I think that it's unknown. The future is unknown because you have to start creating it through the lens of today, really. And it comes back to that creativity. If we can't just rely on a predicted future, we have to create that future. And you'd reminded me of something, Saugata Mitra, who we had on the show just before the summer, talked about that actually the education system isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it should be doing, and it's in terms of a system, it's almost near perfect in what it should be doing. It's just actually we don't need that. We don't need that anymore. I guess if you looked at Blockbusters before they went out of business, they were probably very, very efficient business who were doing very much what they needed to be doing. It's just they didn't say that. Nobody else thought it was.
Yeah, well, I think that's a fair point. From a literacy perspective, it's doing the job on the whole for what it needs to do. But we need much more than literacy now. We need empathy. We need creativity. We need all of these other, what would have been once upon a time, soft skills. And they're not actually becoming, we see it now more and more, you know, in leadership, in big business, you know, having empathy is become such a big word now, hasn't it? You know, for leaders, empathetic leaders are the best types of leaders now. You know, that's, if you look at Harvard Business Review, there's you know, there's research and reports boundless around this subject. So, you know, we need to filter some of that thinking. You know, HBR is a really good place to look, actually, because they talk about empathy, they talk about creativity as being really important factors, you know, in business. And therefore we've got to come back to the source. We've got to bring that back to childhood, because we start out, kids start out with empathy, kids start out with creativity, but we're losing it along the way. And we need to re-inject it.
I'd love to jump into some of that stuff on empathy soon. Sorry, Steve, I think I jumped in front of you. Sorry.
No, you do it, mate. Go on, go for it.
So, and I know that we'll talk about the work that you're doing with Ed at Empathy Week and whatever else, but I'm just interested to hear when you were talking about how some of the big businesses, and we've talked about education there as well, as a big business that's massively engineered to be successful in what it does, and we're suggesting that it's probably doing really well at what it, for its purpose, to churn out students that are qualified and that have got exam grades. It's doing pretty well at that. So there's a method, the methodology from Lego as well, that's this idea around deconstruction and about unpicking the building blocks. It's not saying we're going to knock down the wall and then we're going to get brand new materials here. We're talking about the building blocks that we acknowledge are as part of our system, that we can deconstruct those and then reconstruct that, maybe use new bricks as well as old bricks to build what we need to do. And I think I really like that idea. And I'll just give a little anecdote if I can, before we get into that idea around deconstruction, is that I volunteer with an organization that supports, in the summer holidays, we do a little bit of work for children and families who might struggle with food and stuff in that holiday time. And we run kids clubs and whatever else. And so we have a few interesting characters, let's just say, that come to that. And I always get assigned some of our more hyperactive boys, because I am a hyperactive boy. So I know how to understand hyperactive boys. I'm working with these two hyperactive boys and they are wild, as in running around and can't sit down, can't do the things that... And we just got a big, massive box of Lego, like an old box of Lego. And this is not even a joke. I'm not just saying this because you sat in here. And these two boys who could not sit still for more than about 30 seconds played for 45 minutes and did not want to leave because they were playing. And they made me keep their stuff for the next day that they were coming so that they could build on it next time. And what it basically told me is that it sometimes those kind of things help with a level of helping with behavior as much as it's about learning. But those boys, if we could, the conversations I was having with them whilst we were building Lego for 45 minutes was amazing. But I think it's interesting because it's that deconstruction stuff that I wanted to get into, really, that idea around working with what we've already got and then repurposing it. Is that I suppose that's part of what you do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a perfect analogy, really. I think, we're not looking to tear things down. As you rightly say, some of these organizations are incredibly successful. And what they're looking for is just an ability to adapt and change. Sometimes some organizations will want to completely wholesale change, but it's unusual because there's so much investment in time, people, product, etc. It's not that easy just for a wholesale change. But they do recognize that, and I like the analogy of using some old bricks and adding new bricks. That's just a fantastic way of thinking about it, Ben, because I think that's absolutely right. It's saying, how can we use some of our existing thinking, the stuff that's good, and how can we add to that and make what we do even better? Every organization, every business knows that it can't go in the same direction forever. So while the going is good, so to speak, now is the time to adapt and change and look at different futures. And using things like Lego is really interesting because we can do what we can do with things like systems work. So you can almost take a helicopter view of your organization. So you could build your organization, not literally, because everything we do is metaphorical. It's all metaphors, storytelling through metaphors. But we can actually do something where we can build systems out. We can build out your business, your organization, the people within it, the agents that you deal with, your supply chain, whatever those external factors are, governments, they can be anything. And we can look at it and we can say, that's our organization. We have effectively constructed our organization today. We can now deconstruct it, take bits away, and add new bits here and try and change things over here. And what it is it gives them a safe ability, you know, to effectively change their business using the Lego model rather than actually changing their business. And then they can actually try different things through it. They can say, well, what if Brexit happens as it did? Well, if Brexit happens, we're going to have to think about these supply chain guys over here. This is going to be a problem with legislation over here. They can suddenly start to have that helicopter view of their organization or their system and look at how they can change it before they actually change it. And effectively, again, coming back to the idea of prototyping change. So you're right. So I think it's the ability to take what you've got, deconstructing where necessary and constructing anew when it serves you. And I think, you know, it's just such a great way of doing it in a very safe and relatively inexpensive way, really. And just interesting, your story about the kids. What I love about Lego, it has the exact opposite effect as well. I do some work with an education charity called City Gateway in Tower Hamlets, London, working with 16 to 24 year old kids, basically, who you know, are looking to get into the world of work or into higher education. They don't have the current educational standards and skills that can get them there. And quite often they might have, you know, challenges in their home lives and all sorts of different things that they have to deal with, which is making it difficult for them. And what City Gateway do is they help get them talking to employers in the city, get them interview techniques, help them get their skills to the place where they need to be. And I've been recently starting to do some Lego sessions with them, with their new intakes coming in. And I just did one actually last week with about a dozen young kids, all in their sort of late teens. And it was fantastic because, you know, they were actually able to express what their aspirations were. What were the challenges? I do this thing called enablers and blockers. What are the things that are blocking you from doing the things that you want to do? What would help you, you know, what would enable you to do that? And what are your aspirations? So we did a lot of work around that. And it was just magnificent to see some actually very introverted and quiet people who literally wouldn't say boo to a ghost, actually opening up and having a conversation. And at the end of that session, I had one particular student who was incredibly shy, very, very quiet, who actually came back and asked me a question. And out of all of the sessions I've probably done, I think for me that was one of the most powerful changes that I'd seen, is that somebody who could have just sat there for hours and hours and not said anything actually had the bravery after doing a session to come back and ask a question. It was a small thing, but quite a big thing. And to see that sort of change is so powerful. And that's what I love about using creativity. It can just open up people a little bit. Even a little change is a big step forward. And I think that's, you know, that's just so encouraging to see.
Everybody unmuted. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting. I'm just trying to kind of I'm ticking it in my head. Maybe I need to play with it at the same point. But I'm just like, Ben might have to jump in here. I'm probably losing my chain of thought. But it's just a really interesting thing of the generally that's not covered in England. We're not looking at projects. We're not doing activities when we fear skills because we think that the subject knowledge is so important, and we've gone both ways and we've had conversations around the importance of everything, and it shouldn't be this versus that. And I was at a conference yesterday, and I won't say who I had a conversation with around this topic, but it was around the digital focus of education and the development of children in Ireland, and it was around the work that has been done in the EU and some of the research that's been carried across into Ireland, luckily. Whether that information will ever carry across in England anymore in the education system, most unlikely. But it was all around digital skill development, critical thinking, and how they're tying in research in the EU that bullying, online safety, if you develop students' critical thinking and digital skills, the risk of all of those is reduced because you've developed the child. But it got onto a really interesting topic around deciphering and critically analysing and thinking around topics that are accessed. The children are connected to the world, rightly or wrongly, to their device on a regular basis. We hear so much information as adults trying to understand whether that is factual based on some of the crazy sources that you would never have thought would be putting out information that isn't factual. How can we support our young children to digitally create as well as doing it through play? And all of these, I think it all plays hand in hand, but it goes back to the fact that you must want and need and have an understanding of that should be a focus. And right now in England and many countries, it's not seen as a focus. We want to focus on filling empty vessels of knowledge. If I was at a conference, potentially in different places, I just probably wouldn't have that conversation. It was enlightening, I think, based on who I was having the conversation with. Yeah, it was really interesting. Yeah, absolutely fascinated by it. And how can you use Lego? There are some online resources in terms of some of the stuff where children can play, develop their skills, because the people that are coming out of education often as an employer I'm looking at some of these people and they do not have those skills. They do not have, and they fear just giving it a go and playing, and because they think it's just too much of a risk.
But it comes back to that conversation that we've had multiple times about, because it's based on high stakes, everything's high stakes. If it's not measurable, if it's not accessible, if it's not examinable, then it's not worth anything. And I think that's the key, that what we're talking about here is that it's not necessarily just playing, like you said, without a purpose. It's playing with purpose, but that purpose is not just about passing exams and getting to the next stage. This is the bit, I think we're getting into like the macro philosophy of what we keep going on about in terms of edufuturists, is that the purpose of education cannot just be utilitarian. It can't just be about transactional. We get kids to know this stuff so they pass this test, so they go to this place, and that's it. We're talking about things that are truly transformational. We're talking about things that are going to stay with them beyond sixth form and university, that be with them for life. So I think that leads us really nicely into that conversation around empathy. And you mentioned it a few times, Sean, this idea of the value of empathy and how businesses are seeing that. And I know that you work closely on the board with Ed and the team at Empathy Week. Ed Kerwin was on our podcast episode 164. I checked it out before. If anybody wants to go back and have a listen to that. But tell us a little bit about why you got involved with that. And I know probably because you think empathy matters, but tell us about that.
Yeah, well, interestingly, so my wife has a charity called Courageous Leaders, which she's been running for a few years, which is a kind of side thing. It's a passion of hers, which she set up as a charitable foundation for kids in Africa. She's a Zimbabwean, and she wanted to help young girls who typically drop out of education around 12, 13, to be able to have further education. And she wanted to find a way of being able to do that. And a good way of doing that was being able to raise money and work with Plan International and to be able to create those donations. So that's something she's been doing for the last few years. And I'm heavily, as you can imagine, involved in supporting that and helping her make that happen. Because, as I said, it's really her side project. She has a full-time job, like all of us. And we actually met Ed through that. So my wife is also involved as an advisor on the board of Empathy Week. He came to one of our Courageous Leaders events. And we just struck up a conversation with him and really loved what he was doing. He was talking about empathy. He kind of tied very much in with courage around leadership. And it was certainly, it was a topic that was starting to be discussed in leadership, in business. And it's something that I now talk about much more so. And I think as a consequence of obviously working with Ed as well. You know, when I'm doing work, I'm talking to a business at the moment about series of sessions we're going to do, and I've said to them, before we can do anything, before we can problem solve, before we can re-engineer anything, we need your teams to have empathy for each other, for what they do. They need to be able to walk in their shoes. And so for me, it kind of beautifully kind of all intertwines, you know, creativity, courage, empathy. These are all things that we want to see in our children, you know, and actually they already have them in them. And it's just how we continue to allow them to express that and follow that through. And so when, obviously after meeting Ed and talking about what he does, and we really wanted to help him and support him, and, you know, he was a bit of a lone ranger back in those days, you know, he was doing everything himself. And we just thought it was such a fantastic initiative. And it was such a no-brainer that, you know, we need our children. There's a name, it's called empathy, you know, it's a real thing. And we need our children to embrace that and not only embrace it, but they already have it. So why wouldn't we just have them express it more, but make it, in many ways, we're teaching the adults what the kids already know. And we're just trying to embed it into the schooling system. And that's the great work that Ed's doing. You know, he puts an incredible amount of hard work into it. He's a lovely guy. So it's, you know, hard to imagine not supporting him. And it's just such a fantastic thing that he does. And again, he's using creativity to bring empathy into schools through his filmmaking. So I personally feel a lot of synergy with that approach that he has. And really, you know, I'm just there to try and help him as much as I can in terms of elevating what he's doing and working with him. But yeah, it really runs a thread, I think, now through everything that I do. As I said, empathy, creativity, courage, I think are really important features in lots of things that I do and lots of things that I'm now involved in as well.
Yeah, I think it goes back to a point, and you mentioned it, that the vast majority of people, and obviously there are certain individuals, SEND, and in regards to empathy and some of those bits that we just have to take into account. But if we say that the majority of individuals are, in terms of nature, and are born with courage, the lack, you know, children lack of fear, empathy, the creativity, and all these kind of things. But then it faces the facts of nature and nurture, the fact that we do not nurture those skills and develop those over a period of time. What we do is we suppress them and push them down and say, you might be great at that, but it's not important. And now what they're finding in business is a gulf of you develop it, you've got it, suppress it, go around a circle, do all of this, it's a void, and then you have to start to re-nurture it back out of individuals. And it's such a shame, isn't it, that it's not something you have to do all of the time, but I think it's something that we need to nurture for our education.
It's the irony, isn't it? It's the irony that it's becoming more and more important as adults that we have empathy and that we have creativity and that we have courage. All of these things that children have naturally. But yet, you know, we've got that to start with. We're losing it along the way through various reasons, and we need it again when we become adults. And so there's a gap in between, isn't there? And we need it both from businesses and industry, and we need it from education. And we somehow need to draw these two things together, because we've got it here as children, we need it here as adults, and it's leeching out in between. And we need push and pull from both ends, don't we? Because actually, if we were to do that, you know, there would be a way of being able to bring it back in. So there's people like Ed who are obviously doing, and there are, you know, some other organizations that are bringing it into the conversation. I think it's just ironic that business is talking about it more than educational bodies are at the moment. And we need that conversation to be taking much more place actively within the educational institutions.
Yeah, it's crazy that even that word empathy is very much holds a lot of baggage, doesn't it, with being like that soft. It even the word feels like, as it's coming out of my mouth, feels soft. It feels like something that, and I suppose it gets put into that bracket of soft skills. But I don't know if it's a, I don't know if it's a Hollywood invention or, but that idea that to be successful in business, to be an entrepreneur, to be somebody who makes it, you have to have that tough exterior. And to bring the conversation back around at the start of the show, I think Dragon's Den probably perpetuates a lot of those stereotypes as well. You know, even look at the opening sequence of the fact that they're called dragons. But actually, there's not one of that panel on Dragon's Den got successful without first of all having empathy. Because how can you sell yourself as a person of value? How can you present yourself as a person of value? How can you present something you've created as a thing of value unless you understand the needs of the people around you and the needs of a market, to put that term onto it?
And all them dragons do like charity work and work that's helping other people. So it is crazy. I'm with you now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And let's be honest, it's TV, right? It makes for good TV viewing. And that's the reality. But you're absolutely right. You know,
but I think it goes. I mean, that movie, what was it called, with Michael Douglas, Gordon Gekko, like the he like tough, almost sociopathic sense of somebody who makes it big in that world has to be ruthless and has to have almost psychopathic tendencies. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's quite an old language, I think, now. And it's interesting when you talk about, even saying the word empathy, but the more you use it, I think the more powerful it becomes, really. And it can sit up there. And as I said, it is being used in now. It's common parlance, I think, within leadership and businesses. It doesn't mean to say everybody's doing it, but it's being discussed and it's being seen as something that has power. And I think as long as we're seeing that, change will come. You know, it might take time. It will take time. But I think we will see that, you know, and I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, and I think it's, again, to wrap up the hour, it's a moving from the head down into the heart, into the hands, isn't it? And yeah. And that's where I think, or to link it back to the educational system, we do spend a lot of time on the head, on knowledge, on knowing things, but actually that ability to apply it and for it to be actually useful eventually, that knowledge, you need to use the heart, you need to use the hands. And
I think educating the whole is such a, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's where we need to be.
I feel like I need to just jump in with something really quick before we do wrap up. I'm reading a book, it's an old book actually, an oldish book, not an old book, by Matthew Syed. It's called The Greatest, and he links the idea around sport and how that works. And he talks about Plato. Actually, the name Plato means about him being a wrestler because he was a strong man. And there's the idea that we separate academia with physicality. From physicality, and like I was talking to a friend of mine, and her son is in secondary school, and the PE teacher had parents evening, and he was like, "It's not particularly great at PE, is he?" And his mum was like, "Yeah, maybe not school PE, but he competes regionally in karate. He plays off this amount of a handicap in golf." But just because he can't do them things that, or you think it's that idea that somehow there's this, just because they've got a very small skill set or a different skill set, it's not valuable. And then that idea of that separation and being somehow thinking academia is this and sporting prowess and is this and heart stuff and caring for other people and all them kind of things tied together. So, yeah, lovely. Love it. Love it. Sean, it's been a pleasure to talk to you tonight. It feels like one of those episodes where time has gone really, really fast. There's loads of stuff been in there. Really appreciate your time. Appreciate what you're doing. And thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure being in amongst a fellow group of Northerners as well, which I don't get to do so often these days. So thank you for that experience.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Cheers, Sean.